And our guest this morning is Larry Pintak. He spent 5 years covering the Middle East for CBS News from bases in Beirut, Cairo, and Amman, Jordan. He won an Emmy nomination and an Overseas Press Club citation for his coverage of the Iran-Iraq War. He was nominated for a second Emmy for his coverage of the September 1984 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in East Beirut. And he won another Overseas Press Club Award for overall reporting from Lebanon of that same year. Right now, he is working as an independent journalist in the area of the Middle East, and he is the author of a recently published book about Beirut. The title of his book is Beirut Outtakes, a TV correspondent's portrait of America's encounter with terror, and it's published by Lexington Books. And as we talk this morning, if you'd like to call in, perhaps you have questions, you're invited to call in. The telephone number here, again, is 333-WILL, and the toll-free line is 800-222-WILL. Mr. Pintak, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
I think it's a fine book.
I appreciate that.
I'm pleased that you could be with us to talk about it. I think that the place to start out is with your analogy between Lebanon and Connecticut. Now, some people might find it sort of strange to be talking about it in those terms, and it takes some time so to describe it. You devote several pages to it, so perhaps you can do it in a thumbnail kind of version. But I think it brings home to people here in the United States what is going on in Lebanon, and makes it, I think, a little bit easier to approach that way. Maybe you can do that.
Sure. I ask the reader to try to imagine Connecticut divided up amongst many, many factions. Imagine the city of Hartford with, say, Christian fundamentalists in charge of East Hartford and Protestants in charge of West Hartford. Imagine, say, a liberation group from Long Island occupying Fairfield County. Maybe the Army of the Country of Massachusetts has invaded in the north and occupied northern sections of the state. New York has moved into the south, their big rivals with Massachusetts. And the state is divided up amongst these various factions and countries, and each of them jockeying for position. The Christian fundamentalists are training young men fresh out of school in how to fight. The city of Hartford's divided. People are being killed in the streets. Anarchy reigns. And the reason I ask the reader to imagine this is to put Lebanon in a context that they can begin to understand. I mean, we're talking about a country that is 120 miles long, about 30 miles wide. It's about the size of the state of Connecticut. And you have two major foreign armies there. You have dozens of other foreign armies in, either as antagonists or as supposed peacekeepers. You have scores and scores of factions fighting each other. It's a place like no other in the world.
I think that I noted down here that you talk about the size of the place, that there in this country there are 90,000 troops from 16 countries.
That's
right. At one point there were that many?
That's right. There are Syrian troops. Of course, Syria has a huge army of tens of thousands of men in Lebanon. Then there are the Israelis. They still maintain a presence in South Lebanon. You have UN peacekeeping troops, people like... You're going to have to bear with me one second. There's some noise in the background.
Okay, that's all right.
There are UN peacekeeping troops made up of European forces and various others there in Lebanon, trying to keep order, standing, watching as the various factions run back and forth over them and ignore their presence. There are others who've come and gone, like, of course, the Americans, the British, the French, each of whom came to Lebanon trying to help, but, of course, weren't able to do much of anything.
What seems to be the case with Lebanon, Beirut in particular, is that this is a bit flowery, but it's the way that I had been thinking about it, that in a sense that Lebanon is the stage where plays written elsewhere in the Middle East are performed.
Exactly. On the streets of Lebanon, the wars of the Middle East are fought. If two countries have a beef, they don't want to get into an all-out war. They'll take it out on each other in Lebanon. We see it happening again right now. You have, of course, heard about the fighting in Lebanon over the last 3 months between the Christians and the Syrians. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happened there is that the Iraqis have gotten involved in Lebanon. They ended their war with Iran. They hate the Syrians traditionally, and especially because during the war with Iran, Syria supported Iran against Iraq. So now the Iraqis have decided they're going to cause trouble for the Syrians. They're sending weapons and ammunition into the Christians and egging the Christians on in their fight against the Syrians. And so, yet again, we have another Middle Eastern war being fought on Beirut streets.
How did it happen that Beirut was the place where all of these conflicts were displaced to?
Unlucky geography is part of it. The other part of it is the traditional rivalry and bitterness among the Lebanese factions. Lebanon isn't, as many countries in the Third World are, it's an artificial country. It was created by the European powers after World War I as they carved up the Middle East into their little areas of control and influence. And they tossed a bunch of people together who didn't particularly like each other. The Christians and the Druzes had fought through the centuries. Hundreds of years ago, they were battling it out. They had come to an uneasy truce. But then when Lebanon was created, others were thrown into the mix. Sunni Muslims, this is, who considered themselves Syrians, because after all, Lebanon was historically part of Greater Syria. Others, Shiites in South Lebanon and in the Bekaa Valley, they were all thrown into the mix. And then making it even more problematic, they created a constitution that gave the Christians the majority of control. The presidency would belong to the Christians, the head of the army, all of the key positions would be Christian-controlled. And while at that point, back in the mid-40s, Christians were a majority, that soon changed. But they never allowed another census. So as the Muslims became the majority, they wanted their fair share of the pie, and the Christians wouldn't give it to them. Then others, because of the Arab-Israeli conflict, got involved. The Israelis, the Syrians, all were concerned about Lebanon because of its geopolitical significance. You can sit in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon and lob shells into Damascus. That makes the Syrians concerned, so they are naturally concerned about who is in Lebanon in that part of the country.
Mm-hmm. And so each of the countries bordering on Lebanon felt that their security concerns were involved. Countries that even didn't border on Lebanon were somehow using it as a place to settle scores. And the Lebanese people themselves had plenty of old scores to settle as well. So that in a sense, I think you write here at the time that in 1983, at the time when the U.S. Marines went in, that there were at least four definable conflicts in Lebanon. What would those four be?
That would have been the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the conflict between the Syrians and the Israelis, the conflict within Lebanon between the Muslims and the Christians, and then conflicts between the many factions.
Yeah, and one of the things you note in your book is that apparently the Lebanese people have this way of saying that, you know, if everybody else would just get out of here and let us alone, we would be fine. There would be no struggle, no warfare. Nobody would be being killed.
We are a peaceful people. Mm-hmm. That's what you keep hearing over and over and over again.
And would that be the case?
No, it's not. Again, you go back to the fact that back in the 1840s, for example, the Christians and the Druzes were slaughtering each other. There's a wonderful old book written by a man called Colonel Charles Churchill, and he was a British diplomat in Lebanon back in the 1840s, and he chronicles the conflict between the Christians and the Druzes. And the parallels to today are uncanny, especially paralleling the early 80s when the U.S. was involved. At that point in the 1840s, Christians were fighting Druzes. The head of the Druze faction was a man called Jumblatt. Well, the head of the Christian faction now, the head of the Druze faction now is a man called Jumblatt. His top aide was a man called Hamadi. Wali Jumblatt's top aide is now a man called Marwan Hamadi. The French were on the ground trying to keep peace. Unable to, of course, but they were standing there watching the blood flow. Of course, back in the early 80s, the Americans and the French and the British and the Italians were all in Lebanon trying to keep peace. Back in the 1840s, there was a European fleet sitting off the coast. Same thing in the 80s. European diplomats were running back and forth between Beirut and Damascus trying to bring about peace, as Robert McFarlane and and various other American diplomats did. So you see the parallels. I mean, nothing has changed, really, in that 100 years, that 150 years. And while those other foreign forces, the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Israelis, whoever it may be on a given day, are stirring up the mix is there for them to stir up those hatreds and those bitterness, and that penchant for violence exists. They only exploit it.
Yeah. Our guest this morning on Focus 580 is Larry Pintak. He's the author of the book Beirut Outtakes. For 5 years, he covered the Middle East for CBS. And as we talk this morning about Lebanon, if you have questions, you're welcome to call in locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What is amazing is that in the midst of all of this violence and destruction and death, that life in anything like a normal form manages to go on. And yet it does seem to be, in a way, certainly the signs of stress show on these people, and yet they continue to go about their business and try to live their lives in as normal a way as possible. How is that possible, and what is the price that people have to pay, the emotional price?
Well, first of all, it's not only possible, but it's necessary. If you are in that situation, if for whatever reason you can't leave, because most of those with the ability to leave have already done so, if you are there, you have to adapt. You have to learn to adapt and to survive. Otherwise, you die. You wither on the vine. And so I think the thing that impressed me the most about Lebanon was the ability of human beings to adapt to a given situation. No matter how bad it was, it could always get worse. Your house was blown up, well, your children are all right. Your wife was killed, well, at least the kids are still there to help you. Your car was blown up, well, you can always walk to work. Always, no matter what it was, it could always get worse. When we first arrived in Lebanon, we used to get upset at street battles. People were shooting on the streets in front of our house. Well, you learn to live with that. You learn that no big deal. You just stay away from the windows. They'll go away. Then the artillery came along, and my God, they're shelling the neighborhood. Well, you learn to adapt. You learn that you don't stay in rooms that are near the street. You don't stay on the top floor. Otherwise, you're all right. Then the car bombs came along, and that brought a whole new level of horror. You'd walk to the store, and as you mentioned, life does go on. The stores are fully stocked. You can buy, at least a few years ago, you could buy French champagne. You could buy salmon just flown in from Sweden. You could buy Iranian caviar. But on the way home, you may be blown up by a car bomb. Mm-hmm. Well, you learn to adapt to that. Israeli jets come along. You learn to adapt to that. No matter what happened, you always adapted. But there was a psychological and a physical toll being taken. The Lebanese, when you listen to them, you realize that they will be affected for years to come. Children who have grown up with nothing but war. 14 years this round of war has been going on. There are kids who know nothing but killing and death. Many Lebanese children, for example, have hearing problems. Because when they lay in their cribs during the fighting, the rumbling from the artillery damaged their inner ear. Other kids are frightened whenever they hear the rain. We had one friend who, the kid, whenever there was shelling, would run into his bedroom and hide in tears. And eventually, his parents helped him to adapt to the concept of shelling. But then when there was thunder and lightning, he'd run and hide in the room. And they explained to him, well, that's thunder without death. Thunder without shells. And so then he'd hear the thunder and he'd say, is that thunder with shells or without shells? And very, very sad. Another friend had a daughter who one night she walked out into the hallway, and the daughter was laying there on the floor with her blanket and her pillow. The hallway is always the first line of defense when there's fighting. Outside there was a lot of shooting going on, but it was a holiday, and the Lebanese use any excuse to shoot in the air and fire off their weapons. And the mother explained to the daughter, no, it's all right, it's just a holiday, they're only celebrating. And this four-year-old girl looked up at her mother and she said, Mommy, if you want to go in your bed and sleep and die, go ahead, but I'm going to live. I'm going to stay in the hallway.
Yeah. I remember one story that sticks into my mind with two little boys playing with toy cars, and one of them drives up the toy car in front of an imaginary building, pulls something out of his pocket, puts it underneath the car, and the car explodes and flies up into the air, and they were playing car bomb.
Right.
It's staggering, and the book is full of so many stories like that. I think it can almost numb one the way something close to being there must do too.
At times, the problem with when you're put in a situation like that for such a long time, you begin not to see how devastating it is. You don't realize what it's doing to you and to people around you until you leave and suddenly you're off on vacation in Europe and a plane goes over and you duck, or a car backfires and you run behind a wall, and then you realize that it's taking a toll.
Something else, though, that I think is worth talking about, when you look at a conflict like this, the obvious things are the political divisions and ethnic divisions and religious divisions, and it could seem on the surface as if mostly what this is about is politics. But that's not the only thing it's about, and sometimes one wonders if that that may not be the chief thing it's about. Part, at least in part, what this conflict is about is power and making money.
Mm-hmm. Good, very good point. That is the root of it all. The conflict has many layers. It's a political struggle. It's a struggle of Arab nationalists against Lebanese nationalists, Muslim versus Christian, pro-Syrian versus pro-Israeli, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, yes, at the heart, it's a struggle over power. We see it again right now with Michel Aoun, the Christian leader who has declared himself prime minister and declared war on the Christians, declared war on the Syrians. It's just another example of a little man who wants power, who has provoked a conflict, does not care how many thousands of his people are killed, because he has been led to believe that if he takes on the Syrians, the Iraqis will back him up, and maybe somebody else will come to his rescue, and he'll be made president of Lebanon. And that's all he cares about. He doesn't care about the tens of thousands of people who have died in the conflict over the years, or the thousands who have died since he's provoked this latest clash. It's a very, very sad situation.
You do get the impression, and I hesitate to say it. I don't want to do an injustice to the Lebanese people, but you do get the impression that there are an awful lot of people there who are purely out for themselves, that the motivating factor is self-interest.
It's a culture, without trying to generalize too much, but the culture is very me-oriented, very I come first. Whether you're standing in line to get a plane ticket and everyone else is charging forward, elbowing you out of the way, or you're trying to get off the plane and everybody leaps out of their seats and elbows their way to the front, it's me that counts. Nobody else counts. So if we're talking about a choice between me gaining something or a lot of people dying, well, I want to gain something. A good example was, a while back, all the families of the kidnapped got together and formed an organization. Hundreds of people, if not thousands, have been kidnapped over the years in Lebanon by the various factions. And the families finally got together and they said, we want to know what's happened to these people. And families from Christian East Beirut and families from Muslim West Beirut all marched to the Green Line and discussed among themselves. And the bottom line became, well, we'll put pressure on our people to release your guys when you put pressure on your guys to release our people. It was, you know, I come first. I want my family out first. And so the whole thing fell apart. It was typical. The other factor, which you touched on a moment ago, is the people that are making money from the conflict. The same guys that own the glass factories and the cement factories are the guys that run the militias. So they send their boys out to spark a round of fighting in a given neighborhood and destroy that neighborhood, and then they send their other guys in to rebuild that neighborhood. They make out both ways.
Mm. And in addition to the fact that whoever is in control of whatever government there is, there are also great possibilities there to be made through various sorts of legal and illegal means.
Absolutely. Amin Jamil, the president of Lebanon during the U.S. involvement, came to be known as Mr. 10%.
I would like to talk a little bit about the city of Beirut, which is actually two actually two cities, the West and the East, one controlled by the Muslims, one controlled by the Christians. West Beirut, this is the city that is controlled by Muslim factions, although it seems that there are many that, and they perhaps spend as much time fighting amongst themselves as they do with the Christians. What kind of a place is West Beirut?
West Beirut is a very... it's a place that really gets your blood running. There's always something new, always something different. The center of West Beirut is a street called Hamra Street, which is essentially the Fifth Avenue of West Beirut. You go down there, and the shops are full of French clothes and European goods, and shop owners who've been blown out of their shops in other parts of the city have set up on the sidewalk. So you see boxes covered with Gucci shoes, or a car with its trunk open full of Chanel No. 5. And amidst all this is the blare of guys walking by with carts selling cassettes with Arabic music, the music blaring out. There are generators running, creating an enormous din because there's rarely power in the city. It's a city so full of life. Vendors standing with their carts covered with tomatoes and lettuce shouting out the prices. A real vibrant place. But then 5 minutes later, the shells may start coming in, and suddenly everybody clears the streets, the metal shutters come crashing down, and for a little while, everyone hides in the basement. And then the moment the shelling stops, the shutters come winding back up again, everybody's back out on the street, and life goes on. The city, the western part of the city, is divided up amongst numerous factions. At the moment, the Shiite Muslims are, in terms of power, are in the fore. The Syrians have pushed them out to a degree. Syrian troops are in the heart of Beirut, but in other areas, the slums predominantly, the Shiite militias are in charge. Years ago, that was the PLO. The PLO controlled things. Well, no matter who is in overall charge, there are always dozens of other militias. They'll clash one day, they'll be friends the next, and you can never be sure who's going to control which neighborhood.
Mm. This morning in Focus, we're talking with Larry Pintak about his book Beirut Outtakes, a TV correspondent's portrait of America's encounter with terror. This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and this morning we're talking with Larry Pintak for 5 years. He covered the Middle East for CBS and has written a book recently published about Lebanon. His book is Beirut Outtakes, and Lexington Books is the publisher. If you have questions, we welcome those here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free anywhere that you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a moment ago about West Beirut and what kind of a place that is. Let's talk about the other part of the city, East Beirut. This is the part that is controlled by the Christian forces. What sort of place is East Beirut?
East Beirut is a very, very different place. Much more cosmopolitan, much more European. The streets are clean because there are foreign workers that keep them clean. There are traffic cops because the Christians in control there put them on the streets. Where West Beirut is divided up among scores of factions, East Beirut is basically controlled by one major faction. Occasionally there are some clashes, but basically there's an organization called the Lebanese Forces, commonly called the Falange. And they run the place, very much a little fascist mini-state. They call the shots. Nobody questions them. Nobody questions what they're doing. They collect taxes from people. The government does not. They put a surcharge on every movie ticket that's sold, every meal that's sold in restaurants, and they take those profits and they funnel them into their militia, and they funnel them into keeping order in West Beirut, a very orderly society. There may be no trains. Mussolini kept the trains running on time, but the Falangists get the buses going. And you go up to a place called Juni, which is up in the northern end of the Christian enclave, and it's their major port. And it looks like a little Miami Beach. It's all high-rise buildings, glitzy hotels, beach clubs all along this crescent moon of a harbor. And you can forget for a while that you're in Lebanon. You can go to the Casino du Liban and gamble the night away there. You can go to a wonderful restaurant. You can go to a theater. You can go to a movie. And it's very much unlike being in Lebanon. Of course, there is violence there. They are still subject to the whims and the ebb and flow of Lebanon's wars. Lately, in this latest round, Juni has been shelled a lot by the Syrians. But you don't have the same kind of street violence. You don't have the same kind of thugs running around holding you up that you do in West Beirut.
Mm-hmm. It is a place where you can get, in a sense, get away from the conflict as much as you can and still be in Lebanon.
Exactly. There's another thing about the Christians that I might point out is they are very French-oriented. So you go to a place like Juni, and it's likely that you'll hear as much, if not more, French spoken than you will Lebanese.
Hmm.
Because the upper-class Lebanese like to deny the fact that they're even Arabs. They talk about that they descend from the Phoenicians and various other misty folks but way back when. They don't like to talk about the fact that they really emigrated from the Arab hinterlands hundreds of years ago. And so they maintain this facade of Francophile dress, Francophile movies, etc., etc. And you, especially in that situation, you can forget again that you're in Lebanon.
And while, one thing, too, that one might mention, you talked about the fact that there are a number of factions at work in West Beirut, Muslim factions, that while the Falange controls East Beirut, there are a number of different Christian sects as well. There are, I think, ten kinds of Christianity.
Christianity itself, but not in terms of militias. Each of those sects, the Roman Catholics, for example, don't have their own militia. What has happened, though, there are several Christian armies. There is one run by Frangieh, who was at one point the president of Lebanon. He's up in northern Lebanon. He is very much Syrian-allied. He has a blood feud with the Jamaals, the traditional rulers of East Beirut, because they killed his son. So he has split off, but he's off in his own little fiefdom. Within the major Christian enclave, the Lebanese forces really are the power that be. Okay, there have been internal fights within that organization, but since the about 1976, when Bashir Jamal unified the Christian factions by wiping out most of his rivals, that has been the primary force in East Beirut.
Mm-hmm. And yet, there still is a great reservoir of bad feeling because of that, and problems. Problems with unity among all of those parties.
Oh, certainly. I mean, again, there have been lots of internal conflicts. The Shamoun family, another man who was president. See, Lebanon's made up, especially among on the Christian side, made up of mafia-like families. There is the godfather who has served at some point as president, probably, or is an icon of the Christians. And then there is a son or two who will inherit the mantle of power. So that's the case with the Jamaals. Pierre Jamal is the godfather. He essentially unified the Christians. He is the one that created the Lebanese forces, the Falange. He is looked up to, he is now dead, but he's looked up to by all the Christians. His sons, Bashir, who was the fighter, Amin, who eventually became president. Then there's the Shamouns. Camille Shamoun was president. His sons were both in line to take over the mantle of power. They were ultimately crushed by Bashir Jamal. The Frangiehs. Frangieh was president at one point. His sons were ready to take over the mantle of power. One of them was assassinated by Bashir. So you see the pattern there.
Mm-hmm.
These fief-like families, feudal families that are controlling things, the sons who were in line to take over power, the sons who are jockeying for power. And ultimately, Bashir Jamal consolidated power in his family's hands and handed it down to his brother Amin when he was assassinated. And after Amin passed, Amin was not as strong as his brother, so there was internal squabbling among the Christians. But again, there has been occasional street fighting, but it's never fallen to the level of East Bay, of West Beirut. They fight among brothers, so to speak. They never end up dividing up the territory amongst themselves.
Yeah. We have a caller here we'd like to talk with. Other people are welcome to call in locally, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And this caller's on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of a book that was recently published, and I believe it's the author is British, and it's about the Middle East, and I think his name is Smith?
Not offhand, no.
Okay, but he seems to insinuate that what he calls tribalism doesn't allow for, like, a democratic form of government, and he seems to see endless fighting. And that he would talk about other countries throughout the Middle East that they really are not in any way democratic, and that if there are elections, usually people are appointed to run. Or, you know, since I wasn't aware, you know, I don't know enough about the Middle East. But what do you see as the future of Lebanon and of the Middle East? And do you agree with the tribalism concept?
Yeah, I think you're talking about a book called Closed Circle by David Price Jones.
Price Jones, yeah.
He makes a lot of generalizations in the book. Certainly, Arab society is traditionally a tribal, a feudal society with one family in control. And certainly that remains the case throughout most of the Arab world. I mean, you'd only look at Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or the Gulf to see that the families control power. This is not democracy. But I don't think the concept of tribalism and the concept of peace are necessarily mutually exclusive. You can have a tribal society like, again, Saudi Arabia, that is peaceful. A tribal society that is controlled by a powerful family with certain freedoms to its people, but basically they call the shots. That doesn't necessarily mean that things are going to fall apart. In Lebanon, yes, it's partly tribal, it's partly feudal, but there are a lot of other factors involved as well. Do I see peace in Lebanon? No, absolutely not. I don't know how Lebanon will ever solve its problems, because the bitterness is so deeply ingrained, the hatred, the centuries of bloodshed, the Hatfield and McCoy-type blood feuds. I don't know how, even if you eliminate the outside power influence, I'm not sure that you're ever going to get these people to actually get along with each other. And I think sometimes there are parts of the world where we have to accept that they are insoluble. There are problems that the United States and the Western powers can't necessarily settle.
And how do people support themselves? I can see how vendors could support themselves, but what kind of jobs are there?
Well, it's a lot harder now than it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago. When the PLO was there, and I'm not going to try and defend the PLO's occupation of Lebanon by any means, but while the PLO was there, because the PLO is a massive bureaucracy, well-organized, there were millions of dollars a day being poured into the Lebanese economy through the Palestinians. That helped keep that economy going. Another major way the country made money is that it is the trading center for the Middle East. The Lebanese are the middlemen for the Middle East, buying and selling, whether it be arms or cotton, for the Gulf. Another way they made money is that they are an offshore banking center. Lebanon is very much like Switzerland in terms of its banking laws, so a lot of people kept their money there. Now, with A, the PLO gone, B, the economy crumbling, inflation running rampant, it is very difficult for people to survive. Yeah, there are people who are the vendors, there are people who work for the government, there are people who run shops, etc. But you're right, there's no industry there at all. There is no outside money coming in to help stir up the economy, so it's in real bad shape. And I think the only hope for Lebanon, in fact, is the fact that that economy is in such bad shape, because as long as everybody was making money, they could live with the war. They could live with the chaos, because the chaos, the anarchy, meant that they could make money. They didn't have to pay taxes, etc., etc. They could smuggle drugs, scotch, whatever it may be. But now, with so many people having such a tough time getting by, with inflation running rampant, the Lebanese pound, for example, has gone from in 1985, it was about 15 to 1. The latest I heard, it's about 200 to 1. So you can imagine what that's doing to the cost of imported goods. So I think that's the country's one hope, that people are going to turn around and say, my God, we have to live, we have to be able to make money, let's make up and be friends so we can all make a buck.
Okay. And are drugs a problem?
Drugs are not as much of a problem as you may think. Lebanon is a center for the drug trade. You go up to the Baca Valley and you drive through acre upon acre, mile upon mile of hashish fields. Lebanon is a center for the export of hashish and hash oils, etc., to the west. Opium, a lot of the drugs from the Golden Crescent are smuggled down through Lebanon, shipped out through Lebanon. But inside Lebanon, drugs aren't that much of a problem. I mean, sure, the hashish is everywhere, and a lot of the fighters are stoned at various times. But it's not like a lot of people are hooked on heroin or anything now.
Do I have time for one more question?
Sure.
Okay. 20 years ago, people thought that Lebanon would always survive because so many countries had an interest in the trade there and an interest in peace. And that although the government was, the minority was in charge, that it would be worked out. What do you see as what happened? What changed that?
Well, I'm not sure I subscribe to that theory to begin with. But what changed partly was in the late 1950s, Lebanon, the Muslims made a grab for power. As you know, Nasser was the power in Egypt. He was an inspiration to the Arab world. The Nasserites in the 58 elections looked like they were going to make some big gains. The Muslims were going to get a big chunk of the power. And if the Nasserites had gotten in, they would have pushed for reforms that would have given the Muslims an equal share of power. What happened instead was Kamil Shamoun was president at the time. He convinced the Americans that if the Nasserites got into power, it would become another pro-Soviet state. The U.S. had just seen Iraq fall into the Soviet orbit as the monarchy was overthrown. They were afraid of other revolutions across the Arab world. And so we sent the American Marines in, and we quashed what would have been a rebellion. We stopped the logical, natural progression of change in Lebanon, and we put everything on hold. So instead of slowly reforming the system and slowly bringing the Muslims in a natural way that matched their demographics, we forced the Muslims to remain under the Christians for another decade. And so the bitterness dwelled, the bitterness grew, and ultimately in the early 70s it blew up. The arrival of the Palestinians is what eventually set spark to the tinder. The PLO was driven out of Jordan in 1970, Black September, you'll recall. They were shipped into Syria. The Syrians shipped them into Lebanon. And thousands of Palestinians came, and more to the point, their weapons came. So while the majority was already Muslim, this eliminated any doubt that the majority was now Muslim. That pushed it right over the edge. And they brought the weapons that enabled the Muslims to challenge the Christian order.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with Larry Pintak. He, for 5 years, covered the Mideast for CBS and has written a book about Lebanon. His book is entitled Beirut Outtakes. Our numbers here locally, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I want to talk about the more recent involvement of the U.S. in Lebanon. People, I suppose, think of Iran-Contra as being the darkest days of the Reagan administration, but if it hadn't been for our involvement in Lebanon, there probably would not have been any Iran-Contra. We went in there supposedly as neutral peacekeepers. The forces weren't supposed to be involved militarily, but eventually we ended up picking a side, and perhaps it was the side that we had been supporting for a long, long time. Anyway, the Christian side, and the Muslims saw it that way from the beginning. But somehow we managed to seemingly stumble into the middle of a civil war that we didn't understand without knowing why we were there and what would be the likely result. How is it that we managed to go into the situation seemingly so blindly?
We went in initially in the summer of 82 to help protect the PLO evacuation, allow the PLO to get out of Lebanon. As you recall, the Israelis had cornered the PLO in West Beirut, 2-month siege, pounding the city into dust, and So we sent the Marines in with other European forces to provide cover for the evacuation. That went well. We got out. Everything was fine. Then there was a massacre in the Palestinian camps of Sabra and Shatila. We had guaranteed Arafat that we would guarantee the safety of the Palestinians who remained behind. We felt our word had been broken, and the Reagan administration panicked. They sent the Marines charging back in, and while the initial tour in Lebanon, they had a clear-cut mission. When they went charging back in, they didn't know what they were supposed to be doing. We heard over the course of the next few months that they were there as observers. We heard that they were there as peacekeepers. We heard that they were there to prop up the legitimate government of Lebanon. But all of those things are mutually exclusive. If you're an observer, you stand back and you watch, you take notes, and you pass the information on. If you're a peacekeeper, you actively intervene in the fighting. If you're there to prop up a government, you're taking sides. And so we weren't sure what we were doing. The Marines sure weren't sure what they were doing. And the Reagan administration, most crucially, ignored the advice of the experts on the ground. As things started to fall apart, as the Muslims began to perceive that we were taking sides with the Christians, the embassy in Beirut warned Washington. The embassy in Damascus warned Washington. But, see, the Reagan administration wasn't seeing a centuries-old conflict among local factions. They were seeing Reds under the bed. They saw Muslim factions who were supplied by the Syrians, Syrians who were supplied by the Soviets. Hence, this was an east-west conflict. We were fighting the Russians. And it just wasn't so. The embassy in Damascus said it wasn't so. The embassy in Moscow said it wasn't so. The Reagan administration didn't want to listen.
And we were concerned about supporting the government of Amin Gemayel for the same reasons that we had supported the previous government, because they pulled out the Soviet card and they said, look, if you don't back us, this is going to be it.
Exactly. I mean, Amin Gemayel, you know, waved the Soviet threat. Reagan bit. He believed it. He started talking about vital interests and domino theories and that sort of thing. And as many, many other experts who served in Lebanon as American diplomats have said, we have no vital interest in Lebanon.
The tie that still binds us to this country is the Americans that are still being held. One thing that I wonder and had wondered all along was that what did the groups that kidnapped these people hope to gain, and why did they pick these people?
Okay, in terms of what they had to gain, there's a very simple explanation for why these people were kidnapped, and it's gotten lost in the shuffle of big power politics. In 1983, the American embassy in Kuwait was blown up. A group of people were arrested for that action. Some were condemned to death. 17 are in prison in Kuwait. Among those are two people who are related to the men who've kidnapped the Americans in Lebanon. And in the grand old tradition of Lebanese politics, you take one of ours, we're going to take one of yours. So they kidnapped some Americans to trade. Now, the trade's never happened. The Kuwaitis certainly won't trade. The U.S. has stood fast against a trade. And so these people, and then the others who have been kidnapped subsequently, have gotten tied up in the whole issue of U.S.-Iran relations.
Wasn't it the case, though, that some of the people that were kidnapped purely for money? Someone thought that they could get a ransom that way?
Yeah, there's obviously in a country as chaotic as Lebanon, you've got lots of thugs running around, lots of freelancers out to make a buck. And in the case of at least one of the kidnappees, we're fairly certain he was kidnapped by other people and then sold to the, quote, bad guys. A good example of that is another friend of mine, Steve Hagee, who was UPI bureau chief there at the time, was at one point kidnapped by a group of guys. He happened to walk into a robbery in progress in a restaurant. And then these guys saw this American and thought, hey, great. So they took him and robbed his apartment, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, they spent the night driving around the Shiite slums trying to find Islamic Jihad, trying to find Hezbollah in order to sell Steve to Hezbollah. In the end, they never made contact, and Steve was ultimately freed.
What do you think are the long-term prospects for these people who are still being held? One of them, Terry Anderson, who was the AP correspondent there, is starting now his fifth year in captivity.
Right. Terry was kidnapped on March 16th, 4 years ago. And The long-term prospects, I don't know. There have been lots of high points and low points, especially for Terry. Terry, each time others have been released, Terry's been left behind, and it's been tragic, and it's doing bad things to his head, as you can imagine. Terry, parenthetically, is a good friend of mine, a good poker buddy, and Terry has hung on through all of it. When the other Americans were freed, he stayed behind. When the French he was sharing his cell with were freed, he stayed behind, and he held on for a long time. There have been ugly stories lately about him banging his head against a wall and that sort of thing, just beginning to lose it. The only hope is that you look at American POWs who spent 9, 10 years in Vietnamese POW camps, so you have to hope that these guys will come out of it okay. I think ultimately Iran is going to need trade ties with the West. I think ultimately they'll move away from terrorism, and I think now that Khomeini's gone, there's a lot of prospect for that. They'll need to open up those trade ties to the West to rebuild their economy, and obviously the price for those ties has to be freedom for the hostages.
Hmm. The day came when you left, too. This was after U.S. embassy had been bombed. The Marines had been bombed. The new embassy that was built to replace the old one in East Beirut, that had been bombed. Things seemed to be get worse and worse. And at that point, a great many Americans left, and only some diplomats remained, and I guess journalists too. What was it that finally got you to say to yourself, it's time to go?
The sheer odds. We had lived with the kidnapping for about a year from the time Bill Buckley was taken. And all through it, we told ourselves, and I remember having long discussions with Terry Anderson about this, we debated whether or not we were targets. And we told ourselves for a long time that, well, the bad guys needed us. They would want us there to report on the other atrocities they were carrying out, to report on the kidnappings, the bombings, etc. And with the exception of Jerry Levin, the CNN correspondent, no journalists were taken, and that argument seemed to be holding true. Then more and more Americans left, as more and more Americans were kidnapped, and professors at the university began to take off, relief workers began to leave, businessmen had long since gone. And eventually, after the embassy was blown up again, as you say, the new embassy in East Beirut was blown up in September of 84, as the elections approached, there were more and more graphic threats saying we won't rest until every single American has left, etc. And we looked around, and we realized one day that there were about 10 of us left in West Beirut, 10 Americans. And so even if our earlier argument had been true, that we would be the last to be taken, we were the last. And it got to the point where my Lebanese camera team didn't want to go on the street with me. They'd say, we'll go out, we're safer without you. I couldn't walk the 3 or 4 blocks between my home and the office. I'd have to have my driver waiting for me every morning and take a different route. It got to a point where we weren't covering a story. We were the story. We were waiting for... Nobody cared about Lebanon anymore. The only thing we were concerned about was the American involvement. Is the embassy going to be blown up again? Well, we looked around and we realized that, well, there were two things that could be blown up, the embassy or us. And so it just didn't make sense anymore, and ultimately our office ordered us out. Terry stayed, one or two other Americans stayed, and we were kind of commuting back in and out. We moved to Jordan and went in and out often a couple of times a week, the idea being go in, do a story, and get out before the bad guys realize you're there. Terry stayed. And one day he went and did an interview with Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, the spiritual leader of the Lebanese Shiites. And the day after he did that interview, he was kidnapped. And the suspicion is that they didn't even realize he was in town. They went and he went and saw them. They said, hey, there's an American. And the next day he was taken.
Hmm. Just as a final question, what do you think or do you think we have learned anything from our involvement in Lebanon?
Well, I think there's two questions there. What should we have learned and what have we learned? I think we should have learned that we should listen to the people that understand a country. We should pay attention to the experts. We should be aware of the history of a nation when we decide to get involved, that not all issues are black and white, not all issues are good versus bad. The Reagan administration looked at the Christian government as good guys. They were looking for guys in the white hats, but in Lebanon everybody's hats were gray. And that's what we should have learned. Whether the administration has actually learned that is another question. We didn't learn from Vietnam, we didn't learn from other similar disasters, and we just don't seem to learn from history.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David.
Our guest this morning, Larry Pintak, who was for a number of years a CBS correspondent in the Middle East, and he has written a book about some of his experiences, these in Lebanon. His book is Beirut Outtakes, a TV correspondent's portrait of America's encounter with terror, and it is published by Lexington Books.